This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Late afternoon on a clear day in autumn. The light is beginning to fade. The unbroken blue of the sky starts to deepen into black, and there's a scurry of leaves along the pavement. Vaporous thoughts are swirling through my head. Memories of a time when I was a much younger man, and these somber streets, which I've not visited for many years, were the boundaries of my world. The streets of what was then my hometown, Coventry. No, you don't have to stop the music. Not because of that. I know there's an element of bathos, but let me explain. This piece of music, admittedly, was not written about Coventry. It was written by Miklós Rózsa, the great Hungarian composer of film and concert music, in the late 1970s. He wrote it in Paris. It's called Valse Crepusculaire, or Twilight Waltz, and he wrote it for a film called Providence, directed by Alain René. In his autobiography, A Double Life, Rózsa tells us something about how the piece came into being. I first thought of it, he said, walking in the narrow streets of Montparnasse, à la recherche du temps perdu. He scored it, initially, as a little piece for piano and strings, which sounds to me like a nostalgic reminiscence of my youth in La Vie Lumière. By this stage in his career, Rózsa was not writing much music for the cinema anymore. There had been a time, back in the 1940s and 50s, when he was scoring 5 or 6 films a year, but the era of the great Hollywood orchestral score was over. Rózsa had written some of his finest scores for Billy Wilder and George Cukor, for William Wyler and Alfred Hitchcock. But this generation of directors was in steep decline. Directors like Spielberg and George Lucas were still keen to use full orchestral soundtracks, but their composer of choice, John Williams, composed in a brash, confident, unambiguous idiom, which was far removed from the sound world of Rózsa, who had arrived in Hollywood not long after Korngold, Steiner and Tiomkin, and was steeped in their tradition of complex, expressive European concert music. And so Rózsa had spent much of the 1970s not in Hollywood, but at his second home, in the little Italian coastal town of Santa Margherita, where he wrote, among other things, his tripartita for orchestra and his viola concerto. After all, he had little to prove in the film world by now. His scores for Double Indemnity, Spellbound and Ben-Hur were famous all over the world, and he had 3 Academy Awards to his name. He was more than happy to concentrate on concert music, and when the call came through to ask if he would work on Providence, at first he didn't understand. He misheard the name Alain René and thought he was being asked to score a historical drama about Queen René, La Reine René. But, attracted by René's reputation, he came to Paris and began work on the music. So, here we have Miklós Rózsa, one of the 3 or 4 greatest Hollywood composers, with a formidable body of film and concert work behind him, now in his late 60s, walking the narrow streets of Montparnasse at twilight, his head beginning to fill with a wistful, nostalgic melody, which somehow evokes for him memories of the Paris he first came to know as a young man more than 40 years earlier. What were these memories, exactly? What would he have been thinking of? According to his book, his mind went back to one meeting in particular, an evening in 1934. We can be more specific than that, actually. The evening of December 22nd, 1934. Earlier that day, at 4:30, the Salle de Bussy, in the 8th arrondissement, had played host to a programme of chamber music by Rózsa and his friend, the Franco-Swiss composer, Arthur Honegger. Afterwards, Honegger and Rózsa had gone out to dinner together. I should come clean at this point and admit that I have idiosyncratic tastes in music and that Honegger and Rózsa are 2 of my favourite composers. I listen to their music far more often than I do to the music of the generally recognised 20th century greats, and so for me, the idea of them sitting down to dinner together after this concert is very tantalising, particularly as we know it was a dinner that would change Rózsa's life. At this stage, it was not exactly a meeting of equals. Miklós Rozsa was a young composer in his mid-twenties who'd been born and grown up in Budapest before studying for many years in Leipzig. He'd been living in Paris now for about 3 years, renting a ground floor room with piano in the Hotel de Périgord on the Rue de Grammont. He was really known for only one piece, his theme, variations and finale for orchestra, which had enjoyed some modest success in Europe during the early 1930s. Honegger, on the other hand, was a musical star. It's hard to remember this now that his music is so rarely revived, but between the wars he was probably the most famous young composer in France. Works like King David and Pacific 231 had become staples of the concert repertoire. He worked in an apartment at the very top of a modern block of flats, and the main thing Rozsa recalled after visiting him there was his enormous collection of pipes, more than 100 of them, carefully arranged in racks, from which he would choose the most appropriate for his mood after considering first one and then another, as if trying to resolve a problem of counterpoint. History does not record the name of the restaurant where Rozsa and Honegger went out to dinner on the evening of December the 22nd, 1934, but Rozsa does tell us what they talked about. Their joint concert had been a sellout, but the income they'd received from it covered little more than their modest dinner and bottle of wine. It was enough to make the young composer despair. How was he ever going to make a living from writing music? Honegger's answer was simple and unexpected. "You should do what I do," he said, "and write film music." Rozsa was dumbfounded. He never went to the cinema and had no idea at this point what film music was. He thought that Honegger was talking about writing foxtrots and popular songs and couldn't believe that the composer of such great oratorios, such powerful, austere chamber music, could bring himself to deal with such things. But Honegger merely laughed and said nothing like that, and recommended that Rozsa go to a cinema in Paris the next day to watch the Raymond Bénard-directed version of Les Misérables. And this he did. The film itself was good, he wrote, and so was Honegger's music. It was dramatic and lyrical, and so much in his individual style that you would have known who the composer was, even without seeing his name in the titles. I was amazed, and rang him straight away to congratulate him, to tell him I'd learned something new, and to apologise for asking him if he wrote foxtrots. I told him that he should make a suite from the Misérables music, that it was as good as anything else he'd written, and worthy to stand on its own. Later, he did so. So this was the turning point for Miklós Rozsa. Honegger would go on to write a few more film scores, but would soon concentrate his attention on that great cycle of symphonies which dramatises and responds to the violent upheavals which would tear Europe apart in the coming years. He stayed on in Paris throughout the German occupation, but Rozsa would leave, first for London and then for California. With him he would take his high-minded European sensibility and use it dramatically to raise the standard of music written for American films, no matter how often this brought him into conflict with know-nothing Hollywood music directors. It must have seemed enormous to Rozsa, the distance he'd travelled in those years, between his dinner with Honegger in 1934 and his return to Paris in the late 1970s. In that time, he'd more or less invented the sound of two Hollywood genres, the film noir of the 1940s and the ancient Roman or biblical epics of the 1950s and early 60s. In fact, there could not have been many composers anywhere in the world whose work had been heard by so many people. Ah, yes, heard perhaps, but not really listened to. I wonder how that feels if you're as truly serious a composer as he was. I wonder if that bittersweet note of regret, the sense of what might have been, that pulsates unmistakably through this little waltz, has anything to do with that feeling. All those millions of notes put down on paper, all those hours spent conducting orchestras in recording studios, and for what? To create a background noise which will go unnoticed, unremarked, when all the audience really remembers from a picture is the dialogue. Did Rozsa turn away from the concert hall this? Was the price he paid in the end too heavy, in terms of commissions lost, the sacrifice of serious attention from the critics? He never did get to write more than one youthful symphony after all, and yet he wrote hours of music for banal, forgotten films like Desert Fury and The King's Thief, Lady on a Train and The Red Danube. Wait a moment, though. These films are not forgotten entirely. And if many of them are remembered at all, it's for one reason only, because they have music by Miklos Rozsa. Round about the time that he was writing the score for Providence, a strange thing was starting to happen to Rozsa's reputation. Recordings of his concert music have only begun to proliferate in the last decade or two, but suddenly back then, in the 1970s, albums of his film music started to appear. Not the original recordings either, but special suites put together by the composer himself, newly performed by world-class orchestras and released on prestige labels like Deutsche Grammophon. That was how I first discovered his music, on a Polydor LP, which I bought because it featured some 8 or 9 minutes of music from Billy Wilder's The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, music which you could not hear in any other form at that time, along with selections from 6 or 7 other films, which I'd never seen. And here's something which people rarely talk about when they talk about film music. What does film music become? What kind of music is it if you've never seen the film it was meant to complement? That Polydor album contains some of Rozsa's most romantic and beautiful music. I'm thinking in particular of the love theme from an Alexander Korda film called That Hamilton Woman from 1940, and another spectacular tune from a forgotten Mel Oberon vehicle called Lydia, made in 1941. These melodies have lived with me, haunted me, for more than 30 years, ever since I bought that record. But I've never seen either of the films. Come to think of it, I've never seen Alain René's Providence either. And to tell you the truth, I don't want to. I don't want to because, taken out of its context, Rozsa's music has become something other, something more than film music to me now. It's floated free of the cinema screen and embedded itself in my mind, becoming deeply interwoven with my own thoughts, memories and impressions. For most of us, films and real life are well and truly entangled anyway. Nowadays, we all live our lives as if we are characters in movies. Our consciousnesses have been shaped by the cinema, and there's no going back. The movement of our gaze across the horizon is now a tracking shot. Our memories have become flashback sequences. And so, when I revisited Coventry, yes, Coventry, a few weeks ago, and found myself, at twilight, walking the streets which had been so familiar to me many years before, as a student, I didn't have my iPod with me, but I didn't need it. Miklos Rozsa's Valse Crepusculaire began to play inside my head anyway. The music of memory, of wistful regret, of opportunities taken and opportunities missed. The perfect backdrop to any recherche du temps perdu. I don't know what scene it accompanies in the film, and I don't care. It is among the best of Rozsa's film music, and the best of his film music is among the best film music ever written, and the best film music ever written will always transcend its origin and achieve a kind of immortality, because there comes a point where it ceases to be the soundtrack to a film and becomes, instead, the soundtrack to life itself.